sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. My guest today makes the case that our environment, our health, and our consciousness are all profoundly affected by our attitudes toward animals and the choices we make around food. Will Tuttle is author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. He's been a happy and healthy vegan for some 30 years, and he's also has a doctorate in philosophy from UC Berkeley. He's a pianist and a composer. He's trained in Korea as a Zen monk, and he gives talks all over the country. He was recently here in Portland to speak at the annual Veg Fest, and he's speaking to us now by phone, I believe, from Healdsburg, California. Is that right, Will?
Yes. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. Well, anyway, welcome to KBOO. And I guess today is Thanksgiving. I mean, not today, tomorrow is Thanksgiving. And so I thought maybe we could just start a little easy here and ask by just what are you going to be having tomorrow for dinner?
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, every year it's different. It's always a wonderful vegan organic meal. We have usually, for most of the last few years, I've been giving a lecture at a gathering somewhere in the United States, because my wife and I have been living actually for the last 17 years in an RV traveling around the country. And last year we were in Santa Rosa, California, and it was a big vegan potluck, which was just, all kinds of different foods. There's a website that, there's quite a few websites online where people can go to find vegan main dishes for Thanksgiving, stuffed pumpkins and different types of loaves and all kinds of things that one can make. But the year before that, we were at the largest Thanksgiving, the largest vegan Thanksgiving potluck in the country, which was at an animal sanctuary outside Washington, D.C. This year, we're going to be eating dinner with some friends at a vegan restaurant in Lake County, California. It's an all-vegan restaurant. We're having a special meal there. So it's really fun. I mean, we just love it.
And you're basically healthy. You've been doing this for a long, long time.
Very healthy, yes.
I thought when I actually saw you, and I thought, like, I know you're almost 60, and you looked, I mean, I swear you looked 20 or 30 years younger. I was quite amazed. But anyway, there's a whole lot that you talk about in your book, that we'd be healthier, our planet would be healthier, and we'd see an end to things like patriarchy, domination, exploitation, and war. And maybe...
Right.
Like maybe you could just talk a little bit about what is it that has you so convinced of this?
Okay, well, basically what has me so convinced of this is the research that I've been doing for the last 30 years probably 35. I've been a vegan for 33 years, and before that I was a vegetarian for another 5 years. The more I've done research into this, and a variety of research, I got my PhD at Berkeley. It was in philosophy of education, but I was able to really go in depth into peace studies, into sociology, anthropology, public health, social psychology, took quite a few courses in environmental studies, women's studies, and I'm also done a different type of research as a Zen monk in Korea, and just basically living in meditation centers and studying my own mind, basically quieting my mind enough to understand a little bit better, I think, who we are as human beings. I think both types of research are important, and as a musician, perhaps that's helped too. But the basic realization that I've had gradually dawning on me over many years is that all of us are born into a society that has a hidden core that we're not supposed to be aware of. We're supposed to not think about it or talk about it. It's the fundamental taboo in our culture, and that is basically the food system in our society. The fact that we're, for example, in the United States, every single day killing over 75 million animals for food. We have a massive industrialized killing machine that we have created, and the ramifications of this are, you know, just devastating on every level, to our environment, to our physical health, to our psychological health, to our spiritual health, to our cultural health. And we can't even begin to imagine how much better this world would be if and when we move to a plant-based way of eating and living that stops this war against nature, animals, and other people. That is by far, it's of epic proportions. It overshadows everything else we're doing. There's nothing else that comes close.
And you got into the book that the history of this goes back something like 10,000 years with the idea of herding animals.
Right. Yeah. That's a crucial point. And you know, it's hard to give this whole story in a few minutes. But
I know.
But basically, yeah. You know, when people say, well, okay, but you know, this, what you're saying, that couldn't be true because we've been doing this forever. You know, and it's not true. I mean, anthropologists understand this, that we've only been owning animals as property for food, which is called herding, basically, for about 10,000 years. Goes back, as far as we can tell, to Central Asia and to the Eastern Mediterranean, and started out with wild sheep, wild goats, moved to other animals about 2,000 years later, like wild cows. And it was a slow revolution, basically, that happened to humans that did this, and it was a revolution of reductionism, of reducing beings to things. Beings that were before that were respected and were really, in many ways, even not only respected but highly regarded because they had enormous capacities that we still actually today don't understand. Animals, how they are able to migrate and do many things that we can't do. But the basic idea is that they were highly regarded, but once we owned them as property for food, gradually, it took thousands of years, we reduced them to mere property, and they became despised, because when you're owning them, you're impregnating them against their will, you're stealing their babies, you're killing them, you're mutilating them routinely, and so forth. You, as human beings, our natural compassion toward other living beings has to be suppressed in order to be doing this to other animals, especially the female animals, and stealing their babies. I mean, this terrible violence towards female animals and their babies and toward their reproductive cycles and organs and so forth. So we had to create a type of man, basically, that, you know, we had a new male role model of the hard, tough, disconnected male who was capable of sustained violence against animals, women, other men, rival herders, and so forth. And a whole different type of culture emerged, which is essentially the culture that we're living in today, where you have a wealthy elite that basically runs everything. They're this tiny minority. This emerged, you know, about 8,000 years ago. You can see it. I used to teach college courses in the ancient writings, actually, in the San Francisco Bay Area, on the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Iliad, the Odyssey, the ancient Greek plays and writings in the Old Testament and so forth. And you can see very clearly by that point, 3,000 years ago, when these writings emerged, we have a society where there's a wealthy elite. They are rich because they own capital. Capita means head, as in head of livestock. They own sheep and goats and cows. That is their wealth.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Right. And they invented the two primary institutions that are still with us today. They invented war. The oldest word for war that we have is the ancient Sanskrit word gavya, which means the desire for more cows, because they would then attack other and have these mass killing sprees, unfortunately. And whoever lost the war would become enslaved. So we had the invention of slavery. We had the invention of the domination of women. Women were also highly respected because they did something men could never do, which was to bring forth new life. And this was also highly respected. But once men started just impregnating females, cows and sheep and goats and so forth, and seeing them as mere breeders, it was a very small step to seeing women as mere breeders, and it's a very small step to enslaving people as they enslaved animals. And we have created, and we still live in today, a society based on war on slavery, on domination of the feminine, on domination of the earth, of animals, and we have zero chance of surviving on this planet
if we keep this up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's obvious. There's no way, and we will go extinct without even knowing what happened. We won't even know why. But it is our food. Our food choices not only cause the devastation to the environment, which I can go into if you'd like, but they create the mentality within us that not only commits the violence, but also covers it up, so we're not aware of it. We're just basically sleepwalking.
We think it's normal.
We think it's normal.
And
we think it's natural.
Like a couple of other things you had, like the stock market and
right.
the word pecuniary. All that was so fascinating to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Pecuniary means money, but it comes from pecos, which means cow.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, there was a really interesting part in your book where you talked about your own experience that we've so indoctrinated with these attitudes that we're basically, you know, as much as like little kids' stories might have things about, oh, the sweet little farm animals and the pig and the chicken and the cow, we're actually being indoctrinated to not care about animals. And could you talk about your experience as a boy on the farm with the dairy cows?
Well, briefly, yeah, you're totally right, and the indoctrination comes really through the meals, you know, because we're as little kids, we're forced not simply to witness adults eating the flesh and secretions of tortured animals and imprisoned animals, but they force us to do the same thing. And I remember myself growing up in New England, actually in Concord, Massachusetts, I was eating the same foods back in the 1950s that everybody eat, lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and I never questioned it. My mother, I remember I did question it once. I said to my mother, so, Mom, the kind of food we're eating, is this what everybody eats? And my mother just said, yeah, what we're eating, everybody eats this. And then she came back a few minutes later, and she said, well, actually, there are vegetarians, and I had never heard that word before. And she said, don't worry, you know, vegetarians, I've never met one. I don't really know if they actually exist, basically, is what she said. I think she thought they would never get enough protein, so they probably don't really exist. And but my mother was totally right. And like you said, when I was about 13, I went away for a couple of years every summer, for a couple of summers, to a summer camp in Vermont that was affiliated with this beautiful organic dairy where nothing bad could ever happen to anyone. There were chickens running around, a few pigs, a few cows. You know, it was just one of those archetypal happy farms. And I remember at one point going down there, and they told us to catch a chicken. I remember catching my chicken, and they told her to bring her over here. And there was this little board. It was a board on the ground with some nails in it, a couple of nails, and to just put the chicken's neck through the nails. And then I had, in the other hand, I had my axe, and I, you know, just cut her head off. And then she ran around, and then we put the chicken through the scalding tank, and we ate the chickens over the next few days. That everybody did it. We all killed our chickens. And I didn't have any problem with it because I had gone through 13 years of the most intense indoctrination a human being can go through anywhere. I mean, every day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I was told ritually. Rituals are the way we human beings learn something. And anthropologists understand there is no more powerful ritual anywhere than food rituals. Food rituals are the primary way that any society passes its fundamental values and norms from generation to generation. That is how we are essentially indoctrinated into any society when we land here on this planet, when we're born. So I just basically, you know, killed the chickens, ate the chickens. I thought this was right, you know, because I knew in every cell of my being that God gave us these animals to eat. They don't have a soul. They're just put here for us to eat. They taste good. If you don't eat them, you will definitely die within 24 hours of a protein deficiency. And that was it. I knew I was doing the right thing. And a little later, a couple of weeks later, we gathered around a dairy cow down at this farm, and she wasn't giving enough milk anymore. And this is true. I think most people should be aware of this, that on any dairy, organic or not, cows are impregnated at a very young age, younger than they ever would be, in order to get them. And then after 9 months, they give birth to a baby. And then the baby is always stolen right after birth on any dairy, organic or not, which causes enormous suffering to both the mother and the little calf. And then they're impregnated again against their will. And so they're pregnant and lactating simultaneously, which breaks down the health of any mammal very quickly. They're pushed to give more milk than they normally would. And so on any dairy, organic or not, when they reach 4, maybe 5 years old, that's it. They're worn out. Even though these cows would normally live at least 20 to 30 years naturally in the wild, they, after 4 or 5 years, they're worn out. So this is the case. This cow was worn out. She was only 4 or 5 years old, but we were told we were going to use her for meat, and we gathered around with a gun, and somebody, he had the older campers, and take a shot at her and hit her, you know, point-blank range. And finally, I think it was on the third shot, I remember she crashed to the floor of the barn. And it was shocking to me. It was, even though killing the chicken was somewhat shocking too, but with a 2,000-pound animal, just the sheer volume of blood and to see a being reduced in that way was shocking. But I never questioned that we did the right thing. I knew we did the right thing. I knew that, again, if you can't use them for milk, you got to use them for meat. And so I saw all this, but unfortunately I couldn't really question it. And actually, ironically enough, the following year when I went back, instead of doing it in the barn, we the fellow who ran the operation, the summer camp, wanted to do it a little away from the barn, and so we tried to pull this cow over there to this little rise, and she wouldn't go. And
she resisted.
Oh, she resisted so strongly. I mean, we had like 35 kids trying to pull this cow, and we couldn't do it. So then he put a chain around her neck and attached it to the back of a four-wheel drive pickup truck, and he just literally pulled her, yanked, you know. And I was riding in the back of the pickup truck, and I remember when we got almost up to this little knoll, she broke the chain. And when that happened, I think on some level, perhaps, something broke inside of me, because I remember, you know, looking back and seeing this cow looking up at us with this chain hanging from her neck and wishing that we just didn't have to kill her, because I could see how she did not want to die. She was the same as me. I would have been struggling too. I knew she know they these animals know we do not intend something good for them. And so I think you know, for me, perhaps it planted a seed, but still it took many years really before I finally connected all the dots and went, you know, stopped eating meat.
Okay, you need to take a little break here. Sure. We're listening to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with author Will Tuttle, who wrote a book called The World Peace Diet, which, you know, is just full of incredible information that's actually kind of changed the way I'm eating right now, which I didn't expect. But Joanna Macy writes, Will Tuttle brings a priceless perspective, not only to the planetary crisis confronting us all, but also to powerful ways we each can affect it. This book is radiant with his learning and his compassion. And you did mention that we could go more into the environment and health effects, and I would like to do that just
sure.
a bit. So maybe you could just start with the environment. How is our diet affecting our environment?
That's a wonderful question, and it's enormous. And I don't have anywhere near enough time. But the basic idea, like I said, if you're killing 75 million animals every day for food, you have to feed those animals. So basically, when we travel, you know, around North America giving lectures in our solar-powered RV, we see primarily most of the land being converted to monocropped, genetically engineered corn, soybeans, and alfalfa, which is not grown to feed human beings. It's grown to feed animals who are imprisoned in stinking sheds where they never see the light of day until the day they're taken out to be killed. And they eat a huge amount. And so all of this, the genetically engineered corn, all of the herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, the chemical fertilizers all run off into the water. We have soil erosion, water pollution not only of the ground water but also the surface water, running off and creating dead zones in the ocean. Huge dead zones, actually, and the manure from these places is extremely toxic. It's much more toxic than human manure. It's much more of it. I mean, one large pig operation, for example, creates more manure than entire New York City, and there's thousands of these places all around. So it's devastating to the environment in terms of pollution. And then two other things that are really important. It takes a huge amount of water. It takes, basically, according to the United Nations, about 30 times as much fresh water to feed someone eating the standard American diet as someone eating a vegan plant-based diet, probably roughly 12 to 20 to 1 in terms of land and pollution and petroleum use. So, but the other thing is that the oceans are being completely strip-mined of fish. the demand for fish is practically infinite because we're not just feeding fish to human beings, we're feeding them to animals. Most people don't realize, for example, that cows in the United States eat more fish than human beings do. It's called enriching the feed. That's why they give so much milk, and that's how they fatten them up. Cows and pigs and chickens are eating a lot of fish meal. A lot of fish are caught, a lot of bycatch. Half the fish that are caught are thrown back dead. We have a war against the animals in the ocean. Birds are being killed, as well as dolphins and whales and turtles. The large fish species are being fished to extinction. The fish don't have a chance, basically. And now the fish, according to oceanographers, the oceans are basically destroyed by people eating meat.
Yeah, big headline: the broken oceans. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. The broken oceans. The jellyfish are taking over. And then the other thing is we're burning the rainforest and cutting it down at the rate of about an acre per second. The driving force behind the clearing and devastation of the rainforest is basically animal foods, people taking out their wallets and paying for meat, dairy products, and eggs. We're growing soybeans in the rainforest now in the Amazon to feed to factory farm pigs, cows, and chickens, and factory farm fish. We're eating now, two-thirds of the fish we're eating are factory farm now because there's just no fish left in the oceans. They're gone. So this is devastating on every level environmentally. There's nothing worse we're doing to the environment by even close than eating animal foods on every level.
And in your description of the factory farms for fish, the sort of black pools of just fish excrement, kind of, that was like, that got to me.
Yeah, exactly. We have this idea of, you know, somehow we think of it, we call it aquaculture, but it's, people talk about how terrible factory farming is for land animals. I mean, factory farming for water animals is almost infinitely worse. These poor animals are crammed into the water. They're swimming in their own feces. That's why the water's black. All the pesticides and herbicides and everything they have to, and antibiotics, run into the water around them. If they're in pens offshore, for example, like salmon, they're being attacked by sea lice. They can't escape. They can be in swimming pools onshore. Either way, it creates huge amounts of sewage, and the animals suffer enormously before they're killed and while they're living. So eating fish is probably the worst thing anyone can do for the environment. But eating any animal food at all is the worst thing you can do for the environment. It's all of it, and including so-called backyard farming. The whole killing of wildlife essentially is increasing. The Department of Wildlife Services, which is a department within the Department of Agriculture that basically spends millions of dollars and kills many millions of animals every year, coyotes, foxes, bobcats, otters, prairie dogs.
Nuisance animals.
All these nuisance animals. I mean, when people are backyard, it's the backyard and so-called free-range operations that are the primary ones behind this, that are demanding that all other animals be killed. So it's a war against nature that is caused by eating animal foods. And if we don't understand that, and which we don't in our society, otherwise we wouldn't be doing this, then we don't realize that whatever we're sowing, we're going to reap. We're sowing the seeds of slaughter and waste, and it's coming back to us in a lot of different ways.
And and one final thing on that was that just a recent report that methane is way higher than the EPA had actually realized, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, cow and livestock. Warming, fossil fuels, all of that. But there's another factor besides just the health of our planet. There's also the health of our bodies. And could you maybe talk about the difference between vegan health and animal-based diet health?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's eating a plant-based diet is just so much easier to be healthy. It's natural to be healthy, I think, and it's natural to have a proper weight. You know, I mean, so many people are overweight. It's a huge problem. You know, and I eat all I want. I mean, eating a plant-based diet. I do recommend organic. I do recommend whole foods. Also, vegan diet. You can eat a terrible diet, and it can be so-called vegan. So I think, we basically eat grains and vegetables and fruits and some beans, and it's fantastic. I mean, the food gets better and better. But, from the point of view of just anecdotal stories, like myself and my wife, Madeline, longtime vegans, you know, I can tell all kinds of stories, but I can run and run and run. I don't get tired. I mean, it's just, you know, I have a lot of energy because my arteries aren't all clogged up. And yeah, I'm over 60 years old now, and it's not just anecdotal. I haven't been to a doctor in over 35 years. But just in general, if you look statistically, that people who are vegans have far lower rates of illness and far less susceptible to the main diseases that are afflicting everyone, like liver disease and kidney disease and the heart disease and high blood pressure and strokes and breast, prostate, and colon cancer and autoimmune diseases and dementia. All these diseases that basically are filling the hospitals. The diabetes and obesity and osteoporosis, all these things. Now, these are really diseases of excess animal protein, saturated fat, and cholesterol, none of which are in plant-based foods. And so if we eat a diet that's comprised of foods that are more compassionate to animals and to ecosystems and to hungry people, because that's another thing that I think we have to realize is that we're feeding most of the grain we're growing, like 80%, to animals, and they convert it very wastefully into saturated fat, cholesterol, and acidifying animal protein, and huge amounts of sewage, and then people go hungry. We're growing enough food to feed between 12 and 15 billion people, you know, enough to feed everybody twice as much as they can eat, and yet we have roughly a billion of our brothers and sisters starving. And so it's healthier for the body of humanity and for the body of the earth, but it's also healthier for our own cells because fruits and vegetables are actually natural detoxifiers. I was listening to a guy the other day who said that now with Fukushima, he was saying, what should people eat? And he was just saying, well, what you should eat more than anything is lots of fruits and vegetables because those naturally will help clean your tissues and your blood of toxins, including radiation. The worst thing you could eat, of course, is any animal food because fish, everything eats fish meal. I mean, everything. You know, you eat dairy, you're eating a lot of fish meal. You eat eggs, you're eating a lot of fish meal. You eat fish, you're eating a lot of fish meal, you know, because they feed fish to fish, and so, or meat of any kind. Everything, all the toxins concentrate at much higher levels when you move up the food chain. So eat low in the food chain. Eat things that are grown locally, of course, is much better, but you'll be bringing in far fewer toxins into your body.
And so, yeah, basically then it's a lot about toxins. But right. There are people, as you said, that benefit from us eating this way.
Exactly.
And that's kind of a lot of what keeps it going, right?
That's so important. I'm so glad you mentioned that because really underlying this whole thing, you know, I refer to it sort of euphemistically as the military-industrial meat medical pharmaceutical media complex. You know, this vast complex that's in place, and it requires a reliable flood of sick people who are unhealthy, who are diseased physically and mentally, in order to keep making a lot of money. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is enormously profitable and enormously powerful. In many ways, it runs large areas of our government, of agencies, of corporations, of the banking industry behind everything, makes loans to build huge medical centers and hospitals and agriculture operations, animal agriculture. All of this stuff just basically siphons huge amounts of wealth out of the pockets of the people and into the pockets of a tiny elite. It also lays the foundation of war, because when you have such massive inequality where you have some people using huge amounts of land and resources, feeding it to animals and eating the flesh of these animals, while other people are seeing their little kids starving in their arms, that kind of inequality is so unfair and so goes against everything that you know you're going to have war, you're going to have conflict, you're going to have social injustice is natural. It's part of the eating animal foods. Eating meat is extremely elitist. There's nothing more elitist than eating meat and dairy. So that basically drives war, and you have a war machine that enriches the wealthy too. So and not only does it enrich the wealthy, but it allows them to impose more and more restrictions on our freedom. So we have to question the hypnotic trance of our society of imprisoning other living beings and show more compassion for them and for ourselves.
Again, I'd like to just take a moment for an ID break. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm talking with Dr. Will Tuttle, who's written a book called The World Peace Diet. Basically a book which wants us to make the connection between how we're living our lives, what we're doing to the planet, and what we put on our plates. Victoria Morgan, Moran, author of Creating a Charmed Life, has written, "Complete, compassionate, and profound. You'll never again take lightly the question, what's for dinner?" It really, as I said, was an incredible book to read. I kind of stalled around a lot because in the beginning I was still, you know, maybe eating once in a while some meat, not too much. And then finally I'm not eating the meat and the eggs, but I still had my dairy fixes. And the last couple of weeks, I just couldn't do that anymore. I mean, I'm changing out. It's amazing.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it.
But anyway.
I think it's true. You know, when we don't, we're kind of just, all of this stuff is covered up. We don't know. Most people just aren't aware. I met a woman the other day. You know, she's in her 60s. She has a PhD. We were talking a little bit about dairy, and she said, "Wait a minute. Are you saying that they have to make cows pregnant in order to get them to give milk? I thought cows just always gave milk."
Right, that was your rape rack.
Right, exactly. Cow, you know, our violence towards the female, I think that's an important point, you know, that most people don't realize that it's mainly the females that are really abused in animal agriculture because they're kept in the system much longer. They're impregnated against their will, as I said, with their baby stolen. And so this very hard-hearted violence towards the reproductive organs and the motherliness of animals, I think not only is causing them enormous suffering and pain, it also causes us enormous suffering and pain because we reduce, in a sense, we're raised in a society where we're forced to repress what I refer to in the World Peace Diet as Sophia. I think Sophia is the ancient Greek goddess of wisdom, represents the inner sacred feminine dimension of all of us. Whether we're men or women, we have this capacity within us that yearns to protect life and create a safe, loving neighborhood and community for our kids to live in, and this sense of nurturing life. And that, when we're forced to eat meat and especially dairy products, that whole sacred feminine is so violated that we just shut it down. And when that gets shut down, it's great for the corporate industrial complex because then you have people who will just allow corporations to destroy the rainforest and the oceans and the environment and even come invading into the inner lives of our children and treating them as mere consumers and trying to sell them products using all kinds of things like violence and pornography. And we allow that because Sophia has been repressed in our society. So I think what veganism is and what we're talking about this morning in many ways is the resurrection of Sophia. It's this reawakening, this recovery. It's a recovery zone,
right,
for Sophia, our inner essential wisdom, to rise up and say, "No, I'm not going to do this anymore."
Yeah, and that's kind of where it's at. I also wanted to open this up in the second half hour to callers if you want to call in with questions. And the phone number here is 503-231-8187. But when I started trying to talk about this with people that I know, good friends, you know, people who are involved in social justice issues and you know, spiritual things and this and that, it was funny how I found myself kind of running into a kind of resistance from really good people. And I was sort of surprised at that, like that it wasn't like something to just explore, like these sort of arguments would just come up really quickly, and I was going to sort of ask you about some of their arguments just to see what your response would be.
That's a good point, because people believe something. You know, people believe that we need to eat animal foods because we're forced into it from the time we're little kids. So we're programmed. It's a program. And part of the program is there's a few sort of natural excuses that are given, like, well, we have big canines, or we need to eat meat to get the protein, or whatever. And then, but since people are forced to believe something without their permission, I mean, no, eating meat is nothing anyone comes at on their own. No one can argue the fact that no one eats meat or dairy out of their own free choice. They do it for one reason. That is because they're following orders. They're just following orders. They're doing what they were told to do by their parents, ministers, teachers, the government, the media, the corporations, everybody. Bombards us with this from the time we're born. So that's why they're doing it. So no one's comfortable with it, but that basic sense I think in a way it's a healthy guilt. I mean, I didn't feel it in the beginning because I knew when I was eating meat and dairy was the right thing to do, but at a certain point I started thinking, I don't know if this is really the right thing to do, but I didn't really want to hear about it.
Well, it looks like we have a caller already. Eric, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, hi. You're promoting a plant-based diet, and I'm wondering how you suggest that we fertilize all those crops without the use of animal manures as a source of fertilizer.
Okay. I think basically there's a couple of different things. Like when I was a Zen monk in Korea, the traditional way there, one of the traditional things that they did, because I realized when I was in Korea, actually, I was in a community with Sungwangsa Zen Monastery, maybe 150 monks, had been practicing what we would call veganism for 150 years. I mean, excuse me, for 750 years, since the 1200s or something like that. So what we did, we had outhouse, basically, I guess you'd call it, but all the human waste went down, and then there was people who would just mix it in with grass, and we put it on the fields, and they'd been doing that for centuries, and it was, nowadays it's called humanure, but basically, I've been very fortunate, I think, to be able to travel around and talk to people who are farming and gardening, and what's referred to as veganic, you've probably heard of that word perhaps, veganic gardening is basically, the word for it in England is called stock-free gardening, and there are more and more books coming out on this, workshops are being offered on this, but it's being discovered now that you can actually not only grow as much, but even more per output per acre veganically than you can with animal inputs. You do not need animal inputs. You need to give, kind of rethink things a little bit. But basically, we can recycle human manure. We can use compost, of course, and wood chips are fantastic. I think the whole way we do agriculture in our society is, I think, in many ways, has been hijacked by animal agriculture, and so we need to find ways to use all of the manure. So they're spraying manure on fields. I mean, there's so much manure, way more manure than anyone knows what to do with at this point. It's a huge problem. Contrary to what people think, in the permaculture movement, and this is becoming more and more well known, we can definitely grow plenty to feed everybody without any animal inputs at all. They're not required.
We have another question. Steve? Okay. Steve, are you there?
I am.
Hi, what would you like to ask?
Well, it's a comment on just, the fact that I remember my children were small and they preferred meat. You put a bowl of fruit in front of them or a sausage and bacon, and the little ones are going for it. It's natural. I don't know that we're forced or indoctrinated into being carnivorous. I think it's
just natural. What would you have to say to that?
Well, I think it's cultural. I don't think it's natural. I think kids are, when we land on this planet, we're like a little sponge. We just soak up all the subtle cues from around us, from our parents, and from our culture, from everyone around us. And I absolutely do not think it's natural. I think if you have a little kid, with a live animal, like a little rabbit, and maybe a banana, and if that kid starts, ripping apart the rabbit, to eat the rabbit, and you want to take that kid right away to have some serious psychological evaluation and counseling, because it's definitely not natural to inflict harm and kill others. And there's large populations in the world, obviously, like at India or other places, where hundreds of millions of people don't eat any meat at all, never did in their entire lives, and it wouldn't, and that you would never, you know, if it wasn't served, they wouldn't be wanting it. And, you know, for myself, I have to say, I know, you know, I understand what he's saying. You know, I was raised in my family where we ate bacon in the morning, and I used to love bacon. I mean, you know, the salt,
the smell,
the fat,
taste,
that salt and fat, you know, it's the smell of it and everything else, it's like, yum, yum, yum. I love that. You know, I wanted to eat some. My mother said we're having bacon. But if she had told me what it was, if she had said, well, we're having the flesh of a animal that had been confined in a metal crate her entire life, banging her head against the bars, driven into insanity, had her baby stolen, was ripped out, was mutilated in multiple ways, and was hanging upside down by one leg, was stabbed, was bleeding, was screaming, and now we're going to eat her flesh, I would have said, no, let's have something else, please. I don't want to eat that. No, they don't. Kids don't know what they're eating. We trust our parents, and so I think, you know, I've met so many vegan kids that had never ate meat in their life. Traveling and speaking a lot, I've met vegan kids, and they have no desire for meat at all. And I also remember feeding my little sister when she was about 3 and I was about 7, and she kept spitting. I was trying to get her to eat the meat. I was trying to force her to eat the meat because my mother told me to, and she kept spitting it out. She did not want to eat the meat.
Well, it's odd too. My brother's. 2 children, they're in their 30s now, they actually stopped eating any animal meat when they were like toddlers, and my brother and his wife kept eating meat, but their kids wouldn't touch it. So I think it just changes, or it's variable too, this whole thing.
You're right, it is, and it's but a lot of it's cultural, because for example, nowadays if I talk to someone and I say, well, you know, would you like to go vegan? And they say, well, you know, I couldn't do that because I just love the taste of beef. I wouldn't be able to give it up. I love hamburger. You know, it tastes so good. And if I were to say something like, well, could you give up eating dog? They would look at me in horror and say, what? Dog? I'm not going to eat a dog. I don't want to eat dog. Are you kidding? That's terrible. Well, how could you even think such a thing? But I remember being a Zen monk in Korea, and I had the same conversation with people over there, where they would say, you know, would you like to, would it be hard for you to give up beef? Oh, I hate beef. I would never eat it. I would never eat a cow. Well, how about dog? Oh, I don't know. I'm not going to give up my dog. I mean, dog stew is so delicious. I couldn't give that up.
We have Faith on the phone now. What would your question
mm-hmm.
be?
Oh, I was going to make a comment. Let's see. My son's 41 now, but when he was 3, I announced that I wasn't going to be eating meat, fish, or eggs. And, he said, why not? And I said, well, meat is animals. And he was stunned. He said, I am never. Meat is animals. I am never going to eat meat. So he just didn't eat those things growing up. And I was thinking at the same age, a little friend of his, we were in the car, and she pointed to a cow, and she said, hamburger. And so, I mean, just the difference at 3 years old. But another thing is that day when he realized he wasn't going to be eating meat anymore, we were in the grocery store, and he pulled this woman's coat. She was in the meat part, and he said, you're killing animals. And she said, oh, no, no, I'm not killing animals, honey. He said, well, you're making someone else kill them so that you can eat them.
Very
and
wise.
I really did not tell him that, you know.
Wow.
And that was what he figured out at age 3. And so I just wanted to add that is in terms of, you know, what's natural and what people are, little children are, you know, just for him. That was it, just
that's
knowing
impressive.
That was enough. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
That's so interesting. I mean, that shows, I think, in many ways how as little kids we have more wisdom and natural awareness than many adults. Because as adults we've had our natural wisdom suppressed. You know, we've been forced to disconnect the reality on our plates from the reality that it takes to get it on our plates, and we've learned to just stay shallow and not make the connections. You know, we've just learned to obtuse, and unfortunately, that obtuseness and naivete, we're so gullible. We believe pretty much whatever the government tells us. But little kids can see through the whole pretense, and I think. If we give them a chance, they wouldn't want to eat these things.
It's pretty amazing. I just want to take a break again. We're listening to Dr. Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet. Julia Butterfly Hill has written about this book. Use the World Peace Diet as a guide to empower yourself and others in making dietary choices that are powerful beyond what you can imagine. And we have Susan on the phone?
Yeah.
Hi. Would you like to ask your question, Susan?
Yeah, I would like to know if Dr. Tuttle is familiar with the work of Weston Price and what he thinks about his findings and research.
Okay.
Granted, you know, that all of us are, culture is what's why we're doing everything we're doing. And the children, newborn or child, they're not choosing their own food. No child is able to get its own food and choose
right.
what it eats. You know, it has to eat whatever its parents give it. So, everyone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you could address that. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, by the way, this is KBOO Portland. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, I won't talk too long about that. But Weston A. Price, actually, Weston Price was a dentist who traveled around the world and back in the 30s and looked at people's teeth and basically said that eating a processed diet is not good for your teeth, not good for your health. The people that lived in less industrialized cultures had much better teeth and health and jaw structure and so forth. The Weston A. Price Foundation took his findings into an absurd direction. I mean, basically, you know, Weston A. Price never said a word, for example, about soybeans being good or bad or anything. Weston A. Price Foundation does nothing more than try to convince people that soybeans are some kind of toxic substance and to tell people that they should eat lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs, organ meats, and so forth. They get their funding, as is well known, from the meat and dairy industry. They're basically a front group for the meat and dairy industry. And I think, you know, that's what they do. They try to promote meat and dairy, and I don't think there's any sense of understanding or trying to promote the idea of compassion for animals or sustainability, really, because essentially there's a great saying by John McDougall. I've heard him say, he's a... teaches plant-based nutrition in California, and the saying is that people love to have good news about their bad habits. And I think the reason the Weston A. Price Foundation and the meat and dairy industry in general, the paleo diet, and there's quite a few, the Atkins diet, people, unfortunately, we've been forced into eating animal foods from the time we're little kids, and our bodies have had to accommodate to that, and in doing that, we've learned to do that. I mean, our bodies are fabulous, miraculous in their ability to just eat, you know, to thrive on whatever we're feeding them. And so once we're involved in eating animal foods and we're used to it, we like it, it tastes good, and not only that, but we're in a social society where that's what everybody does, and going vegan, even though when we find out the terrible consequences of eating animal foods, the horrible suffering that the animals go through, the human starvation, the environmental devastation, everything else, we don't want to change. We're creatures of habit. We'd rather not change. So it's so great when someone can come along and say, oh, but I'm a type, you know, the blood type diet, for example. You know, just tell people, most people are blood type O. Just write a book that says, well, blood type O has to eat meat because that's what they all did back then or whatever, you know, D'Adamo he comes up with. And I mean, this his theories have been completely, utterly ridiculed, really, by anyone. I mean, they don't make any sense at all. And the same thing with the Weston A. Price Foundation. There's absolutely no scientific background or backing. No one takes them seriously. No one. No one takes the blood type diet seriously. But it's good news for bad habits. It's basically giving people a rationalization to sort of allow them to continue on, because moving into a plant-based diet is disruptive to a normal lifestyle. People, you know, normally you can go out to dinner with everybody, and now you're the odd person that's a vegan, and you know, it requires us, I think, in some ways, to develop our character to be able to say, no, I'm not going to take out my wallet and pay for suffering. I'm going to live according to my values. I'm not going to just be robotically carrying on orders that came from a toxic culture, basically. I mean, this wonderful saying, I think, by Krishnamurti, he said, it is not a good idea to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. you know, it's basically, we want to be well-adjusted. We want to go along. We want to be like everybody else.
We have a couple more calls here. What was the next one? Oh, we don't know his name. Sorry. What's your name?
Mason.
Okay, and what would you like to ask?
Well, I'm with you 100% on the. I understand the environmental reasons and the reasons of treating the animals humanely and I myself I haven't eaten anything from a cow or a pig for probably almost 30 years now. Uh-huh. And but I'm wondering about how Dr. Tuttle, how would you address people who say that we've been hunters and gatherers for millions of years, the anthropologists,
yeah,
for example,
hunting is natural,
and that this is something that is part of our DNA, almost, that it's that, you know, for millions of years, actually, we've been hunters and gatherers.
So, Will, could you address this? We're going to get running out of time.
Sure, yeah. I mean, basically, male meat-eating anthropologists kind of see what they want to see. Richard Leakey has been saying for years that human beings for millions of years ate primarily, overwhelmingly, a plant-based diet, that our closest relatives, the bonobos and chimpanzees, ate at the most 1-3% of their calories are meat, 97-99%, and gorillas is 100%. These are the closest relatives. So this idea that this is natural is actually ridiculous. It's not true. It's been debunked over and over again. We're finding now research is showing that going back, 70, 80, 90,000 years, when we see, going back there, that people were eating grains, and the Neanderthals are actually now, they thought that they ate a lot of meat. They're now seeing that they ate primarily grains. I mean, the more we learn, the more we start having women doing anthropology, and the more we start, understanding what's going on, the more we realize that these are just myths. I remember recently being at a place in an American Indian Museum where people in Virginia, and I always thought that they ate a lot of meat and dairy. And I was talking to the lady there, who was a docent. She was actually descended from these American Indians living in Virginia there. And I said, so what were they eating, because they had corn growing. I said, the corn, what percentage was that? And she said, that was about 1 or 2% of their food was the corn. And then I thought, oh, gosh, I guess they eat more. I said, well, so what else did they eat? She said, well, did they eat meat? She said, they ate meat. It was meat that they hunted and fished was about 1% of their diet. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, about 1%. So what were they eating? 98.7%. What was that? And she said, they were gatherers. They gathered. They gathered acorns.
And so you also had you had something about we have a hinge jaw, our saliva is made
right.
to break down carbohydrates,
our
stomach acid.
Exactly, right, thank you. I mean, our whole physiology is designed for plant-based foods. The ptyalin in our main enzyme in our saliva only does one thing, it breaks down starch. That's what it's designed to do. We don't have the teeth, our jaw structure, our teeth are very soft, and they're... we have very weak hydrochloric acid in our stomachs. We can't break down. We have a long digestive system. We have a circulatory system that doesn't tolerate saturated fat. I mean, we're feeding huge amounts of meat to cows. Cows are eating it. Does that mean they're supposed to be eating meat? It's not in the interest of the cows to eat meat. It's in the interest of their exploiters to eat meat. That's how they fatten them up. The same thing with us. It's not in our interest to eat meat. It's in the interest of the exploiters to tell us these stories that we're supposed to be eating this way. That's how, because we're being exploited if we're eating meat.
Okay, our last question is going to be George. George, are you still there?
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to ask?
I would like to just say to Dr. Tuttle, and then I have a question. Thank you so much for your many insights, deep insights into the sources of our really terrifying, serious problems today. And then I would like to ask if you are familiar with the work of Dr. Max Gerson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he's in the Gerson therapy, and he was forced to leave the country, and his daughter's carrying on his work.
He was forced.
Of cancer in Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah, he was forced to leave Germany, fleeing Adolf Hitler. He was a Jew with his daughters and came to America,
right.
And the New York Medical Society and the American Medical Association persecuted him when they found out he was actually able to cure cancer in some, in a certain percentage of cases. What do you think of his work?
Well, as I understand it, he's able to cure people primarily by cleaning up their diet and moving to a plant-based diet that's healthy. and it works really well. I mean, I haven't personally gone down there, but I've seen videos about his work, and I've seen research that shows that it's very effective. So I think, you know, it's another indication that we human beings are designed to be healthy and thrive, and also that we have a system that is very sinister. You know, that if anyone does something that's actually going to help heal people, they will not be able to do that, because the cancer industry, the heart disease industry, and the pharmaceutical industry want people to be disempowered so that they can make money. And that's what I'm saying. We have to question all the official stories in our society, and I'm really grateful for you to bring that up. Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to mention, too, that he would agree with you on so many of your points. One of his most important sayings was, the soil is our external metabolism, and when we impoverish it or rob it or do not return the excrements of the cities and the animals to it, we end up with diseased and weak plant nutrition, and then we end up with diseased and weak human nutrition, and we get all kinds of the same diseases. You mentioned diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and many others.
Right, right. That's so true. Exactly. The way we do modern animal agriculture, we've basically stripped the soil away. We grow everything in chemicals. We eat the chemicals. And we feed these chemicals to these poor animals. The animals are sick, they're toxic, and we're eating, and the toxins concentrate in their flesh, and especially in dairy products and eggs, and we're eating that. And so we have to realize, you know, as we sow, so shall we reap. If we want to create a beautiful experience on this earth, there's nothing stopping us. We can do it. We have a beautiful, abundant planet. We just have to act in a way that we're deserving of it. We have to show compassion and kindness to other living beings, to the webs of life that we're embedded in here on this beautiful planet, and then we can live in harmony. But right now, the fundamental thing is to stop the violence towards animals, allow them to live their lives, and let them be healthy, and we will find that it'll be possible for us to be healthy. And I think the greatest thing anyone can do is to question the official stories, all of them, and move our lives so that we are actually living in accordance with our values, like you're saying. And I think as we do that, we can create a possibility for our children's future.
Thank you so much. This is, I think, deep wisdom.
Do you see this as actually trending in the direction that you want it to go, Dr. Tuttle?
You know, it is. We are definitely trending in the direction we want it to go, in the sense of there's more and more people that are waking from the cultural trance of violence towards animals and humans and themselves, and it's happening. I think the tempo has to really increase very quickly. As you mentioned, the methane levels in the atmosphere, the warming of the polar ice caps, there are scientists now saying that we've gone beyond the point of no return, and it's maybe too late. So, you know, I mean, in any event, we really, there's nothing more essential, more totally important for anyone to do than to understand the ramifications of our food choices on every level, environmentally, spiritually, psychologically, and to move toward a plant-based diet, and to tell other people to share this with other people, to help spread this message. It's the greatest gift we can give to others, is to help them move toward a plant-based diet for ethical reasons, to help free animals, to free ourselves, to free this earth from the prison of violence and, unfortunately, of stupidity. I mean, in the sense, we're not making the connections. We're not seeing it. We're living in a way where we're taught to not make connections. And so the health of our society and ourselves and of all the other creatures, I think, really hangs in the balance at this point. It's a very important time now.
We're on the tenterhooks. And you yourself, maybe you could give your website and talk a little about your online talks and training programs that you have. We have 2 minutes left or less.
Right. Okay, yeah, just briefly, anyone can go to worldpeacediet.com or worldpeacediet.org. WillTuttle.com is the other website. I'm a musician. I play the piano, so there's some CDs there. My wife's an artist from Switzerland. We have an online training, the World Peace Diet Facilitator Training and Mastery Program. I travel a lot and give lectures. The World Peace Diet has been translated into many languages, and we're going to Taiwan in January.
It was actually number one on Amazon, a bestseller.
Yes, yeah, it was, back in 2010. And now we're and yeah so yeah this it's actually yeah it's the message is definitely getting out. It's a bestseller in Israel right now too. It's in Hebrew, and we're going to Australia, New Zealand as well. So it's really something that a message that needs to be heard, I think, more and more. And we're happy to try to help as best we can anyone who's interested.
So just check that out online, the World Peace Diet, or get a copy of the World Peace Diet. It's a very intense book. And I just want to thank you, Will, for being on our show.
Thank you, Stephanie.
And this has been, I've been speaking with author Will Tuttle, whose book, The World Peace Diet, traces the demands that we make, and it traces the connection between what we're eating and what was required to get it onto our plates, and really talks about how we could transform everything by just changing this. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I want to thank Tammy for her engineering, and thank all of you for listening.
It's KBOO Portland. Stand by for jazz.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, November 27th. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, starting Friday and continuing until the end of the year, Grassroots Book and Music will be holding its fourth annual book drive. The drive is focused on expanding the influence of the Start Making a Reader Today, or SMART, program. SMART, available to students in grades K-3, focuses on helping young people appreciate the joy of reading. Adult volunteers read to children in a classroom setting, and students receive books to take home. SMART operates in 200 Oregon schools. Those who buy books for donation to SMART receive a 20% discount.
Seattle residents are being encouraged to practice gun safety through a new program called Lock It Up or Public Health, which offers discounts on locks for lockboxes, safes, and trigger locks. Customers receive a 15% discount when they mention the program. Law enforcement groups also emphasize safety when citizens request concealed pistol licenses. The objective is to make locking guns up as automatic as using seatbelts in cars. Between 1999 and 2012, there were 68 youth who died of gunshot wounds and 120